is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, the head of the U.S. Africa Command says security threats are growing across the continent, and at least 13 people were killed in western Ghana when a truck loaded with mining explosives detonated. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The head of the U.S. Africa Command says security threats are growing across the continent. In his first on-camera interview since taking command 2 years ago, General Stephen Townsend spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carl Abab about his increasing concerns, including the spread of violent extremist groups, the role of Russian mercenaries, military inroads by China, and threats from Iran.
The U.S. military has now confirmed reports that Russian mercenaries known as the Wagner Group are in Mali. General Stephen Townsend, the commander of U.S. Africa Command, told VOA Thursday that Mali's junta brought in hundreds of foreign fighters to protect their regime.
Wagner is in Mali. They are there, we think, in numbering several hundred now. They're deploying there, supported by the Russian military. Russian Air Force airplanes are delivering them. The world can see this happening. So it's a great concern to us. And the reason it concerns me and it concerns the neighbors there is we have watched Wagner, this mercenary outfit, work on the African continent. We've watched them in the Central African Republic, Sudan, Libya. They don't follow anybody's rules but their own. They will exploit the country. They will create, they will break laws. They will do gross violations of human rights. They will kill innocents and civilians. And then when the Malian people get tired of them, they won't leave.
Townsend, who took over U.S. Africa Command in 2019, also told VOA the most active global competitor in Africa is not Russia, but China. Beijing, he says, is following billions of dollars of economic investments on the continent with creeping, steady, and strategic military investments. In 2017, China's military opened up a base in Djibouti, just a few kilometers away from Camp Lemonnier, the United States' only military base in Africa. The general said Beijing now looks to Africa's western coast, intent on building a military airbase or naval facility in Equatorial Guinea.
They're putting chips down in all these countries on the Atlantic coast. They know that they won't get a yes in many cases from many of those countries. But by asking and trying to get a base in all these countries, one or two of them may say yes. And we think that the place that they've got traction right now is Equatorial Guinea. We're not asking them to choose between China and us. What we're asking them to do is consider their other international partners and their concerns, because a Chinese military base in Equatorial Guinea is of great concern to the U.S. and all of their other partners.
In addition to Chinese military expansion, Townsend said he's monitoring a less obvious threat to U.S. interest on the continent, the one from Iran.
We are starting to see them express increasing interest in Africa and starting to make some inroads there. I think their inroads are going to be malign in nature. And so we're just keeping an eye on it. That's very nascent, but it's happening now, and we're watching it.
Can you give us any examples? Can you get into a couple of examples of that?
I'll just say that they're intelligence-related, and they're the arm of the Iranian security apparatus that engages in malign activity in the Middle East is the same arm that's now engaged on the African continent.
A U.S. official confirmed to VOA that after a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's elite Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps plotted assassination attempts on American diplomats in Africa and is still looking for revenge targets there. Iran has dismissed the accusations as baseless. Due to concerns over increased threats, officials say in the past year, the U.S. military has brought in new and improved defense systems and anti-drone weapons to Camp Lemonnier. The Pentagon has just completed a global posture review of U.S. forces and military resources around the world. A review that Townsend says, quote, ratified AFRICOM's current posture. The command did, however, lose some funding for military exercises with African partners. And for the last year, Townsend says he has shuttled troops in and out of Somalia. Donald Trump ordered most of the 800 U.S. troops out of the war-torn country in 2020 in one of his last foreign policy moves as American president.
They are in bases in the region, and we commute to work. And so who's in Somalia every day is less than 100.
How's that affecting the mission?
We are working hard to get our tasks done. I think that there's more effective and efficient ways to do that. We provided those recommendations to the Secretary of Defense, and we're waiting for decisions there.
But as Townsend awaits decisions from the Pentagon, political infighting continues in Mogadishu, where al-Qaeda affiliate al-Shabaab is adding to its ranks.
The threat of al-Shabaab is growing, and if increased pressure is not applied to al-Shabaab, I'm concerned that there's going to be a significant al-Shabaab attack. We've seen just suicide bombs going off in Mogadishu over the last 2 weeks. So I think they're expanding and they're a growing threat.
The January 12th attack on the Somali capital killed at least 8 people. Carla Babb, VOA News.
At least 13 people were killed and dozens more injured in western Ghana when a truck loaded with mining explosives detonated. Ghanaian officials say hundreds of houses were damaged in the blast. Kent Mensah reports from the capital, Accra.
The police say preliminary investigation has established that a truck filled with explosives for mining collided with a motorcycle, resulting in the explosion at Bogoso Apieti, a village 300 kilometers west of Accra. Authorities say 500 buildings were destroyed in the explosion, displacing over 500 people. A resident of the village, Francisca Brobe, described the blast in a phone interview. She said, "We heard a loud bang from the street, so we thought a tire had burst. Suddenly," she said, "we saw huge smoke in the sky and fire, so we started running for safety. Unfortunately, the buildings collapsed on some people. I managed to escape with my children," she said, "although I sustained minor injuries." Police say, along with the 13 dead, the blast injured 179 people, with at least 45 in critical condition. The head of the local government assembly, Isaac Dasmani, told reporters that Apieti is almost a ghost town now, as search and rescue operations continue.
But the whole community is gone. I mean, all the roofs have been ripped off. And then if you look at some of the buildings too, they have also collapsed. Some of them were in their rooms and then they were trapped and they were able to rescue some of them. Some of them, too, unfortunately, before we rescued them, they had already gone. So, in fact, it's a very sad situation for me today.
Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, and opposition leader, John Mahama, expressed their condolences in separate statements on social media, describing the incident as truly sad day in Ghana. A government delegation led by Vice President Mahmoud Bawumia visited the disaster scene Friday morning. In a brief address to the media, he said the government will provide all the resources to help the victims.
It's a sad day. It's a very sad day for all of us. Just to assure you that government is fully engaged in all these processes, and we are going to see to it that the people here are taken care of. We will learn lessons, and those are going to be much later on. But for now, we are very, very concerned about how to complete this rescue effort, how to take care of the injured, how to take care of the families and people who have survived.
Authorities are expected to launch a probe to establish the cause of the blast and recommend measures to avoid a repeat in the future. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Morocco won a major diplomatic victory in 2020 when the then-president, Donald Trump, recognized Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara in exchange for Morocco normalizing diplomatic ties with Israel. As UN Western Sahara envoy Staffan de Mistura began his efforts to promote a political solution to the Western Sahara conflict, the U.S. State Department said it supports the efforts to relaunch a credible political process leading to a lasting and mutually acceptable political solution. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained the U.S. position to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
So this is a restatement in some respects of the 2007 U.S. position that the Moroccan autonomy plan is realistic, serious, and credible, but the ultimate dispensation of Western Sahara has to be negotiated at the United Nations. And this is the Biden administration taking a middle position between what you might call the Trump-Israel position and the European position and other parts of the world that basically say, you know, even if a country like the U.S. is an outlier and recognizes the Moroccan claims, that has no legal future because in the end, a deal has to be made at the United Nations. And even Israel doesn't recognize Morocco's claims, ironically, even though the U.S. recognition was swapped for the Moroccan steps towards normalization with Israel. And as a result of backtracking a little bit by the Biden administration, Morocco has been slow walking aspects of its normalization with Israel. But this middle position, as I said, basically means that the issue will go back to the United Nations under the process we've been talking about. But something else really interesting is going on. In the latest U.S. defense authorization bill, some senators inserted language re-separating Western Sahara from Morocco in terms of U.S. military posture and bars the U.S. from holding annual joint military exercises with Morocco until Rabat shows commitment towards a peace agreement with Western Sahara. Morocco has been attacking this position as the result of, you know, the Algerian lobby and lobbyists like Senator Jim Inhofe, who sponsored this, but he's not a lobbyist, he's a senator. But it's a win for those that believe in the international legal aspects of this that say that Western Sahara is separate and that the U.S. military cooperation with Morocco should in part be used to incentivize forward motion on this issue. Now, under the new legislation, Defense Secretary Austin can bypass the prohibition of military maneuvers if he says that will jeopardize U.S. national security. And I expect the Pentagon will probably make that assertion at some point, given how important Morocco is to U.S. security interests in Africa, particularly in the Sahel. But the Pentagon's working on a report that they're going to issue by March 1st about whether or not they can go ahead with joint military exercises. And this is a new wrinkle in the U.S.-Moroccan relationship.
Now that the U.S. has recognized Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara, does the idea of a referendum have any future?
Well, it has a future under the UN plan and under the 1991 agreement that Morocco is dismissing, as I said, as having no currency. But that's exactly what Polisario and Algeria are calling on Morocco to do. And by extension, the UN and most of its members, go ahead and hold the referendum that you agreed to hold in 1991. And Morocco's position is there will be no referendum because we have an autonomy plan backed by the United States. And now we have recognition by the United States, and that's all that matters. And you may have noticed that Morocco has had diplomatic rows with Germany, Spain, and the European Union this year over the Western Sahara issue, and it's poisoning Morocco's relationships with Europe as Morocco tries to push and pressure European countries into taking the U.S. position. France is a little closer to the U.S. position and to Morocco's position, but still has stated clearly under President Macron that this is ultimately a U.N. process and a U.N.-mediated solution that will have to be the result of a process that gives Morocco control of the territory if that's what's going to happen. Again, France is supportive of Morocco's autonomy plan, but won't go far as the United States in terms of recognizing Morocco's claims.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. There is a new vaccine in the fight against COVID-19. Scientists at the U.S. National School of Tropical Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, have developed a new COVID-19 vaccine they say will help get more people immunized in low-income countries. Corbivax was developed by a team led by Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, and Professor Maria Elena Botazizi, associate dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine. The researchers say their vaccine is cheaper to produce and distribute, and they do not intend to patent it, allowing anyone with the capacity to reproduce it. Africa 54's health correspondent Lenocht Moudou spoke to Professor Hotez and Botazizi for more on the vaccine.
Corbevax is really the vaccine that was co-developed by Biological E in India. We managed to transfer the technology of how to make a recombinant protein. In this case, it's a receptor binding domain that really targets the original virus. But now, of course, we know that it also can confer really great protection against the variant of concerns, especially Beta and Delta, and we're in studies right now to evaluate Omicron. So we take this engineering of recombinant proteins, we produce the constructs, we call them seeds, and then we transfer these to the manufacturers like BioE. Then we provide them, you know, the procedures of how we can produce them in the lab, and then they, of course, scale them to industrial scales. I mean, Biological E can make 100 million doses of this vaccine, right, from the recipe that we originally gave them. And as with Biological E, we're doing it with many other manufacturers such that they can then really increase the availability. After, you know, major studies, clinical studies in India, we can now see that this is a very efficacious and safe and highly producible vaccine.
Dr. Tez, why is this vaccine suitable for low and middle income countries?
Well, the real advantage is, number one, it's there's no limit to the amount you could scale. You can make billions of doses. It uses an older technology similar to that used to make the recombinant hepatitis B vaccine. And that's significant because that vaccine is made locally in multiple countries in the global south, in India and Indonesia and Bangladesh and Vietnam and Brazil and elsewhere. So that if you need to produce a vaccine locally, this is the technology to do it. We've transferred the technology with no patents, no strings attached, and we help in the co-development to at least four countries so far, with more to follow: India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and now Botswana. This potentially could be actually made in sub-Saharan Africa. BioE is the first, the furthest along, the one in India. They've made now 150 million doses. That's ready to roll out, and they have the capacity for a billion doses. It's a high bar because we've got to provide 9 billion doses for low and middle income countries, 20 billion globally. I doubt we're going to do that with mRNA vaccines and the other technologies. So this will come in order to get people vaccinated by 2022. And if we really work hard and get people vaccinated now, potentially we can forestall a new variant for the summer.
What are the prospects of this vaccine being approved by the EU and the United States for travelers?
Biological E, who is a vaccine manufacturer that has years of experience working with the World Health Organization, and many of their vaccines are pre-qualified, are already working with the agencies to seek that emergency listing for the global use. We can also increase the level of distribution around the world.
There have been a very big challenge around vaccine hesitancy. There are countries where vaccines have been thrown away because people were refusing to get vaccinated. What do you think will make Corbevax different, where people will be more accepting?
They've already taken a vaccine like it through the hepatitis B vaccine, similar to yeast fermentation technology, either for themselves or their kids. Easy to scale, one of the lowest cost vaccines, one of the best safety profiles, a tried and true technology. People are willing to accept it. So when you go down the checklist, our vaccine checks a lot of boxes.
What are the main takeaways then when we talk about Corbevax as a new vaccine coming in the pool of vaccine against COVID-19?
Having very trustworthy partnerships, I think that it was key, right? So our vaccine center has been working for years with the developing country vaccine manufacturer network, working directly with locations in the low middle income countries to enable them, you know, self-sufficiency and self-reliance. The fact that we already had 10-year prior experience working with coronavirus vaccines that really enabled that this technology could be very rapidly readapted for the COVID-19 sequence. The procedures are very well known. The regulators know about them. The manufacturers know about them. The supply requirements are very well established. So they're accessible and they're affordable. And the best takeaway is this could be a game changer also in acceptance because it's already comes with years of experience in how they behave with regards to safety, including safety in a very young population.
You know, at some point, someone has to step up and say, what are we going to do to really help the world's low and middle income countries? And to tie it down with bickering and fighting over legalities and patents and intellectual property, this is not the way. At some point, we have to show a humanitarian concern for all the world's people. And at the same time, it's even in our own enlightened self-interest to prevent these new variants.
Dr. Pitalutas, Dr. Maria Elena Butazi, thank you so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, and Professor Maria Elena Botazizi, associate dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine, speaking with Africa 54's health correspondent, Lenocht Moudou. The Africa Cup of Nations heads into the knockout stages Sunday. Host Cameroon leads a heavyweight list of contenders into the last 16, but according to Reuters, the Comoros Islands, Equatorial Guinea, and Gambia have stolen the spotlight. Equatorial Guinea's 1-0 win over defending champion Algeria and Comoros' 3-2 triumph over Ghana this week were among the greatest upsets in the tournament's history. Algeria's 34-match winning streak ended with 2 losses and a draw and left the team reeling ahead of World Cup qualification matches. Sunday, Burkina Faso faces Gabon. Senegal, the pre-tournament favorite but badly affected by COVID-19 issues, will face Cape Verde on Tuesday. Nigeria, the only team to advance from the group stages at 100%, will battle Tunisia. In Wednesday's round of 16 matches, Ivory Coast and Egypt will clash with the winner to meet either Morocco or Malawi in the last 8. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.